Welcome to Oncology Today, current and future role of immune checkpoint inhibitors and other novel therapies in urothelial bladder cancer, a special program focused on recently published and emerging clinical research. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Ashish Kamat from the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. In addition to this audio podcast, there's also a video component with Dr. Kamat's presentation. To begin, I asked Dr. Kamat to provide an overview of the field. Why don't we start talking about non-muscle invasive disease? If you could kind of just track the recent history before checkpoint inhibitors, like what we learned about that, and then we'll get into, you know, sort of what's been going on in terms of pembrolizumab and checkpoint inhibitors.
Yeah, non-muscle invasive bladder cancer by itself is the right terminology to use nowadays, because for many, many years and decades, people called it superficial bladder cancer. And in some ways, that not only kind of upset the patients that heard, oh, my cancer is superficial, but I think it in some ways halted and stilted the development of therapeutics in that area, because it wasn't recognized as to how serious a disease it is. That plus the complexities of understanding what is TA disease, what's T1 disease, what exactly is the lamina propria. If you look at classification systems, the American classification system is quite different from the European. And then the NCCN uses sort of an amalgamation of both systems. So there have been so many little nuances when it comes to bladder cancer in the non-muscle invasive space that I think investigators and pharmaceutical companies and, very importantly, regulatory bodies really did not know how to assess drug therapeutics in this space, which is why really BCG was approved in 1990 and nothing really of note was approved after that, other than one blip with a particular chemotherapeutic, which really had a dismal response rate at 2 years of 4%, right? So there was a big lull in any drug therapeutic trial development. When trials were designed, they were read out and regulatory bodies could not make head or tail of what it meant, because it was all over the place, risk classification, grades of tumors, stage of tumors. And that's why when the community, when I say the community, I mean the International Bladder Cancer Group, the GEO-ASCO group, the FDA, Beacon, which is a patient advocacy group, everyone sort of came together and came up with, for starters, a uniform definition of what it means to be BCG unresponsive. And that then led to an explosion of clinical trials in that space. And one drug's already been approved this year, which is pembrolizumab. There's another one which we expect should be approved, which is the gene therapy for that indication. And there's so many other trials that are ongoing. So yeah, I mean, it's exciting times now, but it took a long, long time to make really the recognition of what does it mean to have non-muscle invasive bladder cancer uniformly understood by a lot of people.
So I'd like you to chat a little bit about how BCG failure is classified. But before you do, maybe you could comment a little bit on what we've learned about the mechanism of action of BCG. It's always confused me or befuddled me.
Again, I've worked with BCG for decades, and one of my mentors was Don Lam, who is considered like the father of BCG for bladder cancer in the United States. And what's happened over the years is that it's become more well understood how complex the mechanism of action of BCG is. Fortunately, over the last 10, 12 years, the tools that we have to understand immunologic responses in cancer have really grown exponentially. And a lot of that comes out from the checkpoint inhibitor mechanism of action and all the body of work that Jim Allison and others have done. And because we now have better tools, we're better able to understand how BCG works, but it's actually made it even more obvious to us as to how complex the mechanism or the immune response to BCG is. So it's well recognized now that BCG is not working by one pathway or the other. It's a very broad-based therapeutic, but it's an immune-related therapeutic. So there's a very minimal direct cytotoxicity, but the majority of the effect that occurs is you're harnessing the Th1, Th2 response against a particular antigen. And BCG is currently being studied as a vaccine against COVID-19. It's also been shown to be efficacious against yellow fever and others, and that's the non-cancer part of it. In cancer, it essentially presents the antigen, and in this case, it's bladder cancer, to the host immune cells in a supercharged fashion. And to simplify matters, it really actually activates the entire immune response, but it's predominantly the cellular immune response, not so much the antibody-mediated immune response. So we're understanding the nuances, but you're right when you say that it's so broadly effective that we can't pinpoint any one pathway.
Incidentally, you know, I know there's a BCG shortage. For practical purposes, is this an issue?
It's a huge issue. You know, it's been going on since 2014. What happened around that time is that there were two companies, at least, that provided BCG in North America. And since that time, there's only been one company that provides BCG to North America. And on an average, there's about a demand for 1.2 million doses of BCG for cancer reasons annually across the globe. And the production of BCG is fairly complicated, and there's roughly only about 780 to 800,000 doses of BCG that are produced per year. So there's a huge shortage of BCG in North America. It's been going on for a long time. We worked with the FDA and other regulatory bodies, and there's a lot of BCG in the world, right? So there's plenty of BCG to go around internationally, because it's used in countries like India, where I grew up, in Africa, and other places to vaccinate babies when they're born. But in the U.S., you have to go through, obviously, a regulatory pathway and get it approved. So there's a SWOG study going on right now that's actually comparing the U.S. BCG, which is the Tice BCG, against a Tokyo BCG, which is called the Tokyo Strain BCG. And the goal of that study is to show at least equivalence, and then hopefully allow us to get BCG from another place into the country to allow our patients access to it.
So for practical purposes, what do you suggest if people can't access BCG?
That's an issue that we, and when I say we, I mean collectively, the American Urological Association, the Society of Urologic Oncology, BCAN, which is the bladder cancer advocacy group, IBCG, and others have put out guidance statements. And essentially what that guidance statement states is that it's very, very important to use BCG only when appropriate. So patients that have low-risk non-muscle invasive bladder cancer don't need BCG. They do so well with just resection and a single perioperative instillation of chemotherapy that giving those patients BCG is really over-treating them to a huge extent. Patients that have intermediate-risk bladder cancer would potentially benefit from BCG, and randomized studies have shown that immunotherapy with BCG is better than intravesical chemotherapy, even for those patients. But the risk of progression and metastatic disease is so low, and the benefit mainly is for recurrences, that it is better in those patients to not use BCG and instead use chemotherapy, because that way you can save BCG for those patients who are at highest risk, which is the high-grade bladder cancers, the T1 high-grades, the TA high-grades, and the carcinoma in situ. Now, even with that in mind, there are many centers in the U.S. today, and many of my colleagues that might be listening into this interview, that just have no access to BCG. Their hospital system just cannot get BCG. Centers like ours, which is a cancer center, we have BCG. But if a center does not have BCG at all, there are two options for the patients. Number one, if the patient is able to travel and can go to a neighboring hospital, city, state, whatever, then it would be beneficial to travel and get BCG, because it is really the number one recommended treatment for the high-risk bladder cancer patients. But our patients are older. There are socioeconomic issues with COVID-19. There's travel issues. And if patients can't get immunotherapy with BCG, then they should definitely get intravesical chemotherapy. And combination intravesical chemotherapy seems to be more effective, just as is systemically, than single agent. So that's what we would recommend at this current time.
So can you talk a little bit about the classification of BCG failure? You had a great paper in the Journal of Clinical Oncology in 2016. You're talking about BCG refractory, BCG relapsing, BCG intolerant, BCG unresponsive. Can you kind of go through what those are? And kind of how it plays out clinically.
Right. And again, you know, that topic is, again, a very complex topic. And what we tried to do in that white paper is to simplify it so that our colleagues and even patients, but especially regulatory bodies, understand what those mean. So essentially, the simplest way to think about it is any patient who develops a recurrence of tumor after BCG therapy falls in the category of BCG failure. And within that, there are subcategories, and those subcategories are mainly for the purpose of us understanding whether or not that particular patient would benefit from an attempt with more BCG or other agents. So if a patient cannot tolerate BCG because of side effects, that is in some ways an easy classification. It's BCG intolerance. In today's day and age, with urologists being so much more facile with being able to understand the side effects and do various measures such as using antispasmodics and anticholinergics and even dose reduction of BCG, it's less than 10% of patients that have to stop BCG purely for side effects. Not that long ago in the 1990s, prospective studies had more than like 80% of patients stopping BCG due to side effects. Now that's less than 20% and it's closer to 10%. But that's BCG intolerance, which would be a small number of patients. Now, if a patient fails BCG and has never, ever been disease-free, that is considered BCG refractory disease. So that tumor has never, ever gone away, so it's refractory. If a tumor has responded but then recurred afterwards, that's a relapsing patient. Now, you might recognize, well, if a patient responds to BCG and then 2 years down the road recurs with a tumor, what's the prognosis there? There's a lot of evidence to suggest that if the immune system has not been stimulated for 2 years and then the tumor recurs, just giving another round of BCG should allow that patient to experience the same disease-free survival as he or she did before. And that's where the confusion comes about. So in order to simplify the regulatory pathway, BCG refractory patients and those that relapse within 6 to 12 months of the last BCG exposure are now grouped together in one group called BCG unresponsive disease. And when a patient has BCG unresponsive disease, he or she essentially now has cancer that will not benefit from any more BCG. And at that point, trying more BCG essentially means that the response rates are lower than the risk of metastatic disease. And clearly, that makes no sense. So you should not use more BCG in that situation. And that group of patients is the one that the FDA has, at least till today, allowed us to do single-arm studies and use that for registration purposes without a control arm, because the only good control there is a radical cystectomy. And there's no real true good control that we can use.
Before we go on, can you just comment a little bit about the types of tolerability problems you see with BCG and, you know, some pearls about how to manage it?
When we talk to our patients, it's important for us to tell our patients that close to 100% of patients will experience some side effects. And some of the side effects are actually good side effects. We want them to experience the side effects. For example, irritation in the bladder, feeling like you have a slight bladder infection, which may last about 6 to 8 hours. And of course, our female patients are more attuned to what that feels like, but explaining to our male patients that they'll have that burning on urination, frequency, a slight low-grade fever. A lot of it is education, because managing a low-grade fever at home with just regular antipyretics is plenty. Managing the frequency, which is having the patient go to the bathroom a little bit more often, is plenty to reassure those patients that those side effects are transient and we don't really need to treat them because they're going to last about 6, 8, maybe 12 hours, but it's a sign that the BCG is working. Now, clearly, when the side effects last longer and they're more localized, that's when we bring in antispasmodics. And there are so many antispasmodics, I don't need to list them, but any antispasmodic that's used is sufficient to actually help a large percentage of our patients. Now, if the fever starts to get to be serious and lasts for more than 6 hours, that's when we need to tell our patients that they need to contact us, because it's a low number of patients, but if a patient actually develops BCG sepsis, that can be a life-threatening issue. And that happens when a patient has inadvertently been catheterized, there's a traumatic catheterization, or there's just a raw surface in the bladder and the BCG gets in and causes a systemic infection. So patients have a high-grade fever that's persistent despite, say, taking Tylenol at home, that's when they should call us. And again, more often than not, we manage it just by talking to them on the phone and reassuring them, having them monitor their vitals. But if it's really high, then they come into the hospital and that's when they get treated with steroids and other agents. Now, one little pearl, and this is based on several Italian studies that were done many years ago and were prospective and showed that it actually helps. One pearl is that in patients that are at a risk of having increased side effects locally, because of their age or just overall frail status, a single dose of a quinolone antibiotic, it doesn't matter which one it is, given to the patient to take at home 6 hours after they void helps. Because what quinolones do is, first of all, they're effective against BCG. So they actually kill that bacteria. But they also decrease the incidence of secondary UTIs, which are a big cause of side effects in older patients that have high residuals. And when they take that, it actually helps decrease the number of incidences of adverse events and really just tolerability of BCG. But it's important to recognize that we need to make sure our patients don't take it before BCG and don't take it within 6 hours of the BCG, because if taken too early, the antibiotic will kill the BCG and actually prevent the efficacy of BCG setting in, because it's about 6 hours where the cytokines drop after an installation of BCG.
So beginning of this year in January, before things got all crazy, we saw this approval of pembrolizumab. It was really amazing. Non-randomized study. Before you get into it, I'm kind of curious, what's the natural history of the patients who went in the KEYNOTE 57 study? It wasn't randomized, but what were you expecting in terms of the natural history of those types of patients?
The patients that were randomized in KEYNOTE 57 are the patients that we chatted about a little bit earlier that are the BCG unresponsive patients. And that trial was designed in the early stages of when the FDA was working with several groups that I mentioned earlier and recognizing that BCG unresponsive patients deserve their own category of clinical trials because there's no true control arm, as you mentioned. It's a non-randomized trial. Now, the final FDA guidance document came out in 2018, at which point the trial had already been underway for a little bit. So the patients on KEYNOTE 57 don't fit the BCG unresponsive definition as it is today to a T, but they're close enough that we consider them BCG unresponsive. So these are patients for whom there is no other alternative. The only alternative is a radical cystectomy, and that's why it's a single-arm, non-randomized study, but the control arm is historic controls, essentially. And it's not listed in the FDA guidance document, but it's sort of understood commonly that if a therapeutic hits a benchmark where the lower limit of confidence interval is about 20%, then that is considered a success. Now, again, the FDA doesn't say that, but that's understood by most experts in the field. The natural history of these patients is that if they don't undergo a radical cystectomy, nothing else to date has really worked with a durable response. Sure, we can try chemotherapeutics, you can put something in the bladder, and you will get a response that's short-lived, doesn't really last for too long. Which is why, as you mentioned, when the data came out from KEYNOTE 57, and full disclosure, I am an advisor for the trial, and I am an author on the paper that's coming out, but even I was very pleasantly surprised, because I wasn't surprised that we got the response rate, which is about 40% at 3 months, because like I said, you can put any therapeutic and you can sort of get that initial response for the most part. But the duration of response, and again, like you mentioned, I probably shouldn't have been surprised because the IOs have that mechanism of action where the tail end flattens out. But it was very pleasantly surprising to see that the patients that had that CR at 3 months, the median duration of response was more than 16 months. It was 16.2 or 3 months to be precise, but more than 16 months, which is great because what it meant is that these patients can be given a trial of pembrolizumab, and you know as soon as 3 months whether they respond or not. And if they don't respond, then you don't have to treat them unnecessarily for too long. But if they respond, then the duration of response median is over a year. So it was really good to see that data. And I think recognizing that, the FDA approved it on January of this year.
And what about the subgroups that were looked at, particularly the PD-L1 levels?
The whole PD-L1 story has sort of been all over the place, different assays, and I don't mean to belabor the point, but I think that's what happened with this study. They were looking at the CPS score. But one of the things that happens with non-muscle invasive bladder cancer that often gets during the discussion is that these tumors, even though they're deadly, they're tiny. And sometimes the biopsy is so small, the pathologist can only make the diagnosis and then they can't do any real stains after that. So all of the staining that was done was in some ways forced on a small tissue sample. And I say that only because there was no correlation whatsoever with PD-L1 status when it comes to these patients. So we can't say that you should do staining or that it's better efficacy. But I don't want to say that and have the audience think that it's because it's not relevant to the pathway. I suspect a lot of it has to do with the limitations of the biopsy and how these tissues were able to be stained.
So any comments about tolerability issues, autoimmune toxicity, which we know we see with these drugs? It kind of looks like what we typically see, most common hypothyroidism, which you see in all the checkpoint trials. One case of colitis, a couple of pneumonitises. I think you had a hypophysitis also. Any comments about tolerability?
Yeah, so, you know, from a urologist perspective, because urologists, for the most part, have not been administering systemic therapy of any kind, including IO agents, it's important to recognize two things. Number one, the tolerability of patients on the study, despite the fact that most of them are older, et cetera, was very similar to the reference AE profile of pembrolizumab. So there was no difference between the AEs that you see in other studies and the patients that have non-muscle invasive bladder cancer that are older and tend to be more frail in general. So that was reassuring. But it's also important to recognize, just as you listed, a lot of the adverse effects and events that were noted are something that unless the urologists are attuned to, or actually their nurses and people that field the telephone calls are attuned to, for example, colitis, if it's not recognized early, and you know this, but the urology office might not recognize that a patient on pembrolizumab that calls in with diarrhea is not just having diarrhea. And that's why I always want to emphasize to anybody that's listening that's not used to doing IO therapy is that it's important to either have your mid-level providers or whoever's fielding the phone calls attend some courses or classes or listen to an interview like this so that we recognize that the adverse event profile, though very similar to the other trials, is something that in the urology practices has almost never been seen to date and definitely not commonly recognized.
So, you know, it's so tempting. These drugs are so well tolerated. It kind of reminds me of the LHRH agonist thing where the urologist got involved with it. But then once chemo came in, that wasn't going to happen. So it is kind of tempting. But yeah, we saw this, you know, I mean, checkpoint inhibitors have only been out there like 6 years now. But we saw this when these first came into practice in the medical oncology offices, the offices, the nurses, nobody was ready. Diarrhea, skin problems, et cetera. So I have been interested to see how this is actually going to play out. I kind of have the feeling initially that the urologists are going to want oncologists to do it, but I don't know. I'll be curious to see. Any predictions?
Early on, so when I say early on, about 3-4 years ago, when this was coming on the forefront, we were actually asked to hold courses at annual meetings for urologists on how to do checkpoint inhibition. And we actually held courses on, you know, what it means, where it's headed, how you could do it, what the side effect profile is, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, because it was mainly in the metastatic setting, there was not that much of an interest by large urology group practices to incorporate this into their own practice. But now that it's moved into earlier and earlier disease stages, in academic centers, really where it's not like the urology department and the medical oncology department have individual revenue streams, it's less of an issue, to be honest with you. I mean, I send my patients across the hall and my colleague will give the IO and then they come back and, you know, I do the monitoring. But in the community practices, especially these larger groups, there's an active interest, and actually they've gone and we've actually held courses online, and there is an active interest in either partnering with medical oncology groups or actually doing it themselves in the community. And I'm really very, very pleased that everybody seems to be doing it the right way. They're getting the training, they're attending these online seminars. Obviously, this year with COVID, everything's online, but even before that, people were actually listening to seminars, sending their people, trying to learn how to do it right.
That's really interesting. One other point I wanted to bring up, and that is I've heard people voice concerns about this strategy in that the idea being that there is a curative approach, cystectomy. There's some people not eligible, they don't want to, et cetera. But we certainly, at this point, I don't think we have any evidence that this is going to be curative, although I don't know, I'd be curious to know what your thoughts are. And the idea that maybe it'll get overutilized, that maybe people will try it when they shouldn't try it because people really could go for a cystectomy. Maybe they'd prefer not to. You know, I don't know, but I have heard that verbalized, and I think it's kind of a logical thought. But what are your thoughts?
You know, Neil, you raise a very important point and one that we have tried to emphasize to anyone that would listen. So I'm glad you brought that up. It's important whenever we talk to our patients to remind them over and over again, if possible, even to the point of like where they get fed up of us telling them that radical cystectomy, removing the bladder, is the only treatment option that has a proven long-term efficacy track record in this disease space. And that once these tumors metastasize, the cure fraction drops dramatically. And you know this, and the audience listening knows this. But it's also telling that in the studies, and in all the studies really, but pembrolizumab is the one that was published, so I can say that, more than 90% of patients that enrolled in the study actually enrolled not because they were not cystectomy candidates, but because they refused a radical cystectomy. So it is ultimately the patient's choice. And if we do our duty and emphasize to the patient that the most curative option is a radical cystectomy, and they say, no, but I still want to try this, then it falls back on us to tell them, okay, we are going to try this one therapy. If it doesn't work at the three-month evaluation, at that point, you should not keep trying to shop around for another drug, because that's when you're actually reaching that place where the window is really closing on the cure fraction per se. But I think a short course of trying drug X, and in this case, drug X is pembrolizumab, with close monitoring and surveillance is actually very reasonable, so long as the patient understands that it's not go from one drug to another drug until you end up one day with metastatic disease and then you're like, we missed the boat.
Now I want to kind of go through some other issues. First of all, neoadjuvant and adjuvant therapy. I've been fascinated by what I've been hearing about neoadjuvant therapy. But let's begin and just talk about what we know about neoadjuvant therapy of bladder cancer.
So, you know, neoadjuvant therapy with bladder cancer, usually when you talk about neoadjuvant therapy, we're talking about neoadjuvant chemotherapy for bladder cancer. And all those studies, starting out with Bart Gershman's study from decades ago, gosh, now it seems like yesterday, but it's decades ago, and the MRC study, et cetera, showed that neoadjuvant chemotherapy clearly improves survival over cystectomy alone. And the ABC meta-analysis suggested that the benefit is about 5 to 9%. Now, in many of the cancers, and you know this because you do a lot of these sort of discussions, right? I mean, people recognize that a 5 to 9% benefit, absolute benefit, is phenomenal, right? I mean, it actually is improving the data. But when it came to bladder cancer, there's always been this resistance and reluctance to actually refer the patient to the medical oncologist for neoadjuvant chemotherapy. We did a workshop at the SUO in 2013, and the most common reason given was that the surgeons felt that, oh, chemotherapy is going to prevent my patient from having surgery, which clearly is not true. So the penetration of cisplatin-based neoadjuvant chemotherapy in the U.S., even today, is about 28 to 30%. Most of the patients who need it still don't get it. And I'm talking about all numbers, right? And these are serum Medicare numbers, not necessarily people that listen to this talk, but all across the country. Which is why now that we have some data coming out, and again, these are small studies, non-randomized, because the randomized studies are still ongoing, but there's some data coming up showing that the checkpoint inhibitors actually have a high enough efficacy in the neoadjuvant setting. There's a renewed interest because the hope is that if the larger and especially the randomized studies suggest that the data from the PURE study, for example, or the Abacus, where the PT0 rates were in the range of 35 to 40% hold true, then there'll be less reluctance on the part of the patients and the urologists to actually have their patients get neoadjuvant chemotherapy because there is a long-term survival benefit to neoadjuvant therapy. And I think moving away from cisplatinum, if we can, and the data shows that it actually holds true, to IOs might allow more patients access to neoadjuvant therapy.
Where do you see this heading? Do you think that we'll end up using IOs alone as neoadjuvant therapy, combined with chemotherapy? What kind of strategy do you think is going to be optimal?
You know, if you'd asked me this before I saw the data coming out from Andrea Necchi and Tom Powell's two studies respectively, I would have said, you know, IOs alone are not going to do it. You're going to need to add it to chemo. And of course, I would have been wrong because the data that came out from the peer study and the APICA study was remarkable. And again, there's a lot of skeptics, and I'm sure a lot of skeptics in the listening audience right now, because the numbers are in some ways too good to be true, and both of them recognize that, right? But in patients that got only single-agent IO, the P0 rates and the downstaging rates were as high as 40%, which is too good to be true. If this actually pans out and holds true in randomized studies that are ongoing right now, I really would be very, very surprised if the neoadjuvant paradigm doesn't shift completely to IO agents, because it's easier to give, shorter course, more tolerable. And we now know, because we've actually been doing surgery on patients who've had IO therapy since 2007, when we did some of the first IPI studies at MD Anderson, myself and Pam Sharma, that it's safe to do surgery on these patients. So we know that's not an issue. So I really think that IOs have the potential to replace chemotherapy, but I do want to caution the audience that so far the data is in non-randomized studies and not large studies.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, we started to see really encouraging neoadjuvant data with checkpoint inhibitors in lung cancer. And then as they got more patients, the numbers started to drop down. It wasn't exciting. But the other thing that happened with some of those studies is they saw a lot of these patients had things on imaging and all, and then when they actually went in, it was like necrotic or not viable tissue. Is that seen also in bladder cancer?
Yeah, that's interesting that you mentioned that, because again, a lot of this, and some people call it pseudo progression, and I think that's a term that's overused a little bit as well. But there'll be these lymph nodes that look large, that like getting increasing metastatic deposits. And then at the time of surgery, and early on, some of these were surgeries that were not done expecting to be curative, but those lymph nodes were just full of lymphoid tissue and there was no active tumor in there. So I think recognizing how imaging plays out with IO therapy and how to do that is something that the community in general has been getting smarter about as the time goes by. And you're right. I really do think that that is a critical issue to be factored in. The other thing that comes to mind when you talk about the IO agents and the neoadjuvant setting and you brought up the lung cancer issue and so on and so forth, is a lot of our patients in bladder cancer that have advanced disease that requires cystectomy also have lung cancers often, and they're small and that second primary or the simultaneous primary. So we've got a fair number of patients across the US that are actually on checkpoint therapy for both tumors at the same time, and there's some interesting data coming out. So again, it's really interesting times in a way, and good for our patients.
It's interesting. In lung cancer early on, they saw that smokers responded better than non-smokers. Has that been looked at with bladder cancer?
I think some of that has to do with the whole TMB story, right? The tumor mutational burden, because, bladder cancers, a lot of lung cancers are extremely, extremely mutated, mutagenic, a lot of new antigens. And there's some data to suggest, and you might know this better than I do, that smoking is correlated with increased neoantigens, even if someone's a recent smoker. So never smokers, it's different. And former smokers from 10, 20 years ago may be different. But current smokers or recently quit smokers, those that we refer to as cancer diagnosis made me quit smokers, tend to have more of these TMB burden. And that correlates with response in bladder cancer. So I think there's something to be said for lung and bladder being so immunogenic and so far on the mutational spectrum that smoking might have something to do with that.
Anything new in terms of adjuvant therapy, particularly as it relates to checkpoint inhibitors? We've seen adjuvant checkpoint inhibitors now utilized all the time in melanoma. Is that likely to happen in bladder cancer in the future?
So when it comes to adjuvant therapy for bladder cancer with chemotherapeutics, there's been lots of studies that have been done, and most of them ended up not having significant enough response rates or benefit to the patient to where it became clinical practice or incorporated in clinical practice. And Cora Sternberg had a large multi-center study probably 10 years ago or so in Italy that closed early because it actually seemed to suggest that patients that got chemo fared worse than patients who didn't get chemo after radical cystectomy. And then more recently, of course, the checkpoint inhibitors have been looked at, and the Atezo data that was presented this year suggests that there was no true benefit to adjuvant immunotherapy after radical cystectomy. And, again, mechanistically, there's some discussion about the fact, if the tumor is removed And maybe patient selection was such that these patients did not have active tumor burden and there's no actual antigen, then what is the immune therapy checkpoint inhibition working against? And maybe it was a patient selection issue, and maybe it needed to be higher risk patients that had micrometastatic disease, but then it wouldn't truly be an adjuvant, right? Then you'd be treating disease per se. But the bottom line is right now, it doesn't seem that IOs are going to change the general lack of benefit of adjuvant therapy for all comers when it comes to radical cystectomy. Now, we can refine that, you know, and there are studies that are looking at particular subsets of patients, patients that have ctDNA that's detectable, et cetera, et cetera. And again, that might be one way in which we could select those patients that will actually benefit from adjuvant IO therapy. But currently, it doesn't seem like the needle is moving too far away from the lack of benefit that we saw with chemo.
So let's talk a little bit about metastatic disease, particularly from the perspective of the urologist in terms of providing an update. And maybe we can start out with the issue of first-line therapy of checkpoint inhibitors. It's been a little interesting to try to follow that and figure it out, FDA, et cetera. Maybe you can kind of go through that issue. And of course, we're talking about the issue of patients who are either not cisplatin eligible or carboplatin eligible right now in terms of first-line therapy. From a practical perspective, kind of how does that go? How does it get played out clinically?
Yeah, no, I'm glad you brought that up because, again, you know, urologists don't necessarily do the therapy themselves when it comes to metastatic disease. But most of the patients that end up with metastatic disease have already established a relationship with their urologist. They've either started out with non-invasive disease or they came in with invasive disease and then had surgery and then unfortunately have metastatic disease at some point during their course. And they often look to us for guidance. And it's easier for the patient to have a discussion with someone that they have a relationship with. And that way, when they go and see our medical oncology colleagues, our medical oncology colleagues don't have to go through everything with them, right? I mean, they already have some discussion. And that's just my prelude per se. But when it comes to first-line therapy, as you mentioned, IOs really are in those patients that are not platinum eligible because currently still platinum is the gold standard. I mean, the response rates are very, very high. They may not be long-term duration, and we'll talk about maintenance therapy later, but you can switch from chemo to maintenance IO and get the best of both. Now, in patients that are not cisplatinum candidates, either because of performance status, cardiac issues, renal function, what have you, neurologic issues, or patients that are not candidates for carbo in the U.S. In the U.S., they have to not be candidates for carbo as well. Those patients are candidates for first-line IO therapy. And the reason for this distinction is because, and again, the actual mature data is anyone's guess. This was an early look by the FDA at the data that was presented that they had access to. And some of the data that has been presented at meetings in an abstract form has shed some light on it. But it appears that the patients who get IO therapy initially don't do as well as the ones that are getting cisplatinum or carboplatin-based chemotherapy for first-line disease if they are not high PD-L1 status. So you have to test for PD-L1 status if they're eligible. If they're not eligible, then yes, IO therapy can be given as first-line therapy.
So in terms of the other patients, at least in the metastatic setting, we haven't seen data to get people to use first-line therapy or combining IO with chemo. But we did see a trial that really instantly changed practice at the ASCO virtual meeting, the Javelin Bladder 100 study. Can you briefly summarize what they looked at and what they found and what you think it means in terms of clinical practice?
Yeah, the Javelin study was actually another one that was so well received and then led to rapid FDA approval of avelumab. And again, it's been incorporated into the practice that it's also raised a lot of discussion behind the scenes as to, you know, are we jumping the gun in some ways? Essentially, there was a study that was led by Tom Powles and Petros Grievous and was in patients who had a best response to chemotherapy with either CR or PR, and then were placed on best standard care or best standard care plus IO agent. And it was shown that clearly the addition of IO therapy improved the parameters for these patients with overall survival and disease-specific survival. And that's the maintenance therapy per se. The IO is not to replace chemotherapy, but it's the maintenance therapy. So it is actually good for our patients because you brought this up earlier as to whether IO therapies will replace cisplatinum in the first-line therapy, and we still don't know that it will. although the data seems to suggest that it may not. But it doesn't take away the fact that the patients can go on cisplatin or carbo-based initial therapy, and those that achieve response, either CR or PR, then benefit from the addition of IO. And again, avelumab was the only one that was studied, and that's the only one that's approved. But again, talking to a lot of my medical oncology colleagues that do this day in and day out, they don't seem to think that there would be much difference in the mechanism of different agents. So in countries where avelumab may not be available, some people are talking about using other agents as maintenance therapy. Putting patients on maintenance IO after response to cisplatin prolongs the median duration of survival. And that's really what has changed the game plan for these patients.
There's five checkpoint inhibitors approved in bladder cancer, I believe. Mostly they've been used second line. So the idea here is to move it up after they finish their first line chemotherapy. Are you seeing this actually being played out in practice in general? Is this what people are doing nowadays? And are they using avelumab? One of the things I hear is in the era of COVID, people are trying to keep people out of infusions. I've heard people say they use Pembro because they can use it every 6 weeks, for example. Any thoughts?
Yeah, so that's where, you know, again, the practicalities of what our patients and we can do with what's going on right now. It's so unfortunate that it's October and COVID is still peaking right now. Just this morning, we saw some data on that. But yeah, I mean, those are real practical considerations, and I have heard that a lot. Not at my center. We are sticking with the trial data per se, but it's not at all unreasonable if a patient can't travel or if there's a center where the cases are going up significantly and there's a lot of COVID patients in the hospital to use Pembro, for example, which is every 6 weeks. At our cancer center, we don't have that many COVID positive patients. In fact, very few. So it's less of a risk. But in a general hospital where you're treating all kinds of patients, that is an actual real consideration.
So whenever I talk with people from other tumor types, breast, lung, et cetera, I always bring up bladder cancer as a shining example of how things are just incredibly different. And one of the things that, you know, I say, there are five checkpoint inhibitors, tell them about all the stuff you and I have just been talking about. And now we get into targeted therapy. So now you've got a TKI and an antibody drug conjugate, which is really exciting. So let's just, again, from the perspective of a urologist, maybe go through how these drugs were developed and how they're being utilized right now, because it really is a really exciting time. Maybe we can start out with enfortumab vedotin, an antibody drug conjugate that targets Nectin-4. We have a bunch, well, several antibody drug conjugates already in practice. Hodgkin's and lymphomas, you have brentuximab vedotin. Breast cancer has like three of them now. They've had T-DM1, they've got an anti-HER1, T-DXd, sacituzumab. So looks like there's a lot of new antibody drug conjugates coming out. What about EV?
Yeah, so, you know, EV was obviously looked at in third line, and it's an anti-Nectin, which is ubiquitous in bladder cancer. And the response rates were in the range of 40%, which was really, really exciting, 30, 40, depending on how you slice the numbers. So that's good. But from a urologist perspective, one of the advantages of EV is that it is very, very suitable to be used in earlier stage disease because Nectin is expressed on bladder tumors of all different stages and grades. And the ADC mechanism or the formulation essentially lends itself to localized therapy, intravesical therapy as well. So there is discussions and talks about using EV for earlier stages of disease because clearly urologists are not going to treat, you know, second and third line metastatic bladder cancer. But using EV with the same ADC but different formulation with intravesical therapy and trying to see if we can get it to actually work against earlier stages of disease and or in combination with checkpoint inhibition, because if you lose the systemic benefit of EV, obviously putting it in the bladder, and these are very high-risk patients, some of them who may have risk of metastatic disease, can you use this in earlier stages, such as even small T2 tumors in a neoadjuvant fashion before cystectomy? And the goal, at least in some of the discussions we've had, is to see maybe you could use EV plus an IO agent and reduce the need for radical cystectomy. So this is something that urologists should absolutely be attuned to, EV moving into the earlier spaces, at least on clinical trials.
I have not heard that, and that is super interesting. Wow, that is amazing. So can you just kind of backtrack a little bit and talk about what antibody drug conjugates are? And enfortumab vedotin sounds like brentuximab vedotin. I think there is a similarity in terms of how it's designed. But I've heard these described as like Trojan horses for chemotherapy. Can you talk about kind of how it works?
Yeah, no, that's a good way to kind of look at it. So obviously you have the antibody and then you have the drug conjugate. That's where the ADC comes in. And the drug conjugate in this case is a tubulin inhibitor, but it could be anything. But here it's then linked to the antibody, which again can be against anything. Sometimes it's EpCAM. In this case, it's Nectin. And Nectin-4 is very ubiquitously expressed on bladder cancer. So the Trojan horse is actually a good example. You deliver the payload to the cell of interest. In this case, it's a bladder cancer cell that is Nectin abundant. The antibody attaches to that, then it's internalized, and then you deliver the payload. And in this case, you disrupt the tubulin pathway with the MME, which is your drug. So I like that Trojan horse thing. I've heard that as well.
And I guess the good thing about it is it doesn't have, even though it's sort of chemotherapy, it doesn't really have chemotherapy side effects, at least not most of them. It looks like when you look at it that the majority of patients benefit. You know, the waterfall plot, it looks like most of them are going down, not all responsive. But what have you observed and what do we know about the efficacy of this drug?
It was not something that anybody was expecting. It was really a huge surprise, but a very pleasant surprise to see the amount of responses you got. With the added advantage that, as you mentioned, because it's a specifically targeted chemotherapy in some ways, there's not that same systemic side effects that you get with general bladder cancer, say cisplatin-based chemotherapy. So the risk-benefit ratio, and in this group of patients where really the duration of response for anything else was less than 3 to 4 months, to see anything that was efficacious and in some ways almost double the duration of response was a huge win. And again, it was approved and is changing the treatment paradigm for these patients.
Any comments in terms of tolerability issues and side effects?
So this is what I hear from my medical oncology colleagues, because I don't treat third-line patients with EV myself. Hopefully I will when we start the intravesical route, if that happens. But it's well-tolerated, but they do have to sort of recognize a few of the very specific to EV type hyperglycemia and other neurotoxicities that come up. Apparently, from what I hear, they're very sort of almost pathognomic of an EV toxicity. So it's easy to pick up and easy to sort of treat, but I don't have any first-hand knowledge.
So the other agent that's out there that's causing a lot of excitement is erdafitinib, an FGFR-targeted therapy. So targeted therapy is now in bladder cancer. Can you talk about erdafitinib in terms of how it works and what we know about its efficacy?
So erdafitinib is a FGFR3 inhibitor with some off FGFR3 target FGFR inhibition. And in general, with the bladder cancer, the way the pathway of bladder cancer carcinogenesis develops, FGFR alterations, whether they're mutations or others, are actually seen more in earlier stages of disease. So lower grade tumors, non-invasive tumors. And that's why there's always been an interest with FGFR inhibition in bladder cancer, but it was initially focused more on the lower grade non-invasive tumors in order to decrease occurrences. But in those patients, the FGFR3 inhibitors, the TKIs, essentially do have adverse events. And because those tumors are not a threat to the patient's life, the patient's trade-off between side effect and benefit was not favoring the FGFR3 inhibitors. Now, fast forward to erda, which again is the same family, but it was studied in patients that had failed prior therapy in the advanced disease. And that's a much smaller subgroup, but because now you're selecting out a smaller subgroup that have FGFR3 alterations and you're targeting those patients, erda in that subgroup of patients actually had had a really good response rate and good tolerability compared to other second and third line agents in those patients. So for the urologists that are listening in, it's kind of interesting how something that was focused initially on the earlier stages of disease, but was too toxic for those patients, ended up having a high enough efficacy in the advanced setting to where the risk-benefit ratio favored the benefit compared to the side effect.
And unfortunately, I guess the majority of patients don't have this alteration. I think it's only 15 or 20%, so not everybody's going to be eligible for it. The other thing is they have seen, I think, some unusual side effects, ocular problems, retinopathy, etc. But theoretically, for those 15 or 20% of people, they could get either erdafitinib or EV. How do you think people are going to decide what comes first?
I think that's now what's happening is, you know, people who weren't doing tumor profiling previously now are almost like have to be forced to do that, because if and when a patient fails first line therapy or second line with IOs, you need to have the knowledge as to whether these patients have the FGFR3 alterations or not. I think the simplest way to look at it is if the patient has FGFR3 alterations, then put them on an ERDA pathway. If they don't, then put them on an EV pathway. That's not to say that EV might not be better even in FGFR3 patients, et cetera, but at least that seems to make mechanistic sense. And the adverse events, the retinopathy that you mentioned, for example, with ERDA, recognizing that it can be a serious problem, but also that it's something that patients can monitor themselves at home. Now, there are apps that patients can use to kind of monitor their vision changes at home and really quickly text their provider or get into one of the EMRs and be told, okay, stop the drug. So I think in patients, it's good to have so many choices, but I think it's actually forcing the community as a whole to recognize that profiling the tumor early and having that information available to then make actionable decision plans later on is the way to do it.
So one final question moving forward. What are your thoughts about the combination of EV and checkpoint pembro? Because I'm hearing a lot of excitement about that. Any thoughts?
I think using that in the earlier stages makes sense, and using that in the later stages makes sense. Because, again, not that the EV was more effective in the patients that had IO before, but there's a lot of discussion about this. But there's some data suggests that patients who had seen IO did better with EV, and that patients who sometimes are on cisplatinum may not do so well until you come in. So it's the sequencing that really gets to be an issue. And do you sequence EV and pembro together after chemo, or do you try to move them in a combination before chemo? That remains to be studied. But I'm really excited because the mechanism of action essentially is a chemo plus IO. People tend to forget that EV is essentially, you know, a targeted chemotherapy. So you're now taking a targeted chemotherapy and combining with IO, and there's no reason not to expect, and we have to study this, but to expect that they'll actually be synergistic.
You know, if you think about it, that strategy has been used in Hodgkin. Right now, the best results they're seeing is with brentuximab vedotin plus chemo. And, you know, I guess if you think about it, that's a key strategy in lung cancer, combining chemo and IO. So, like you say, essentially, that's kind of what you're doing. It's just Trojan horse chemo, if you want to use that term. This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Kamat, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special Oncology Today edition on the current and future role of immune checkpoint inhibitors and other novel therapies in urothelial bladder cancer.